There, thank God.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there. The heat wave is on, but it's really cool in here where I am because the air conditioning's on. And upstate Westchester is beautiful, and my guest is going to tell you that it's not so wonderful in Naples, Florida. It's kind of hot, but that's okay. This discussion's going to be really, really interesting. But first, I would like to say that I am dedicating this show, since it is about romance, and the title of the book is A Flight to Romance by John Fishwick, which you read. This is a unique romantic novel. You're going to really love it because I really loved it too. And the show is dedicated to the memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, MJ of MJ Magazine. My sister was the biggest romantic optimist in the world. I don't think she ever frowned, ever. I think all she ever did was look on the positive side of things. And she would call me every morning and say, you know, are you smiling yet? I go, no, not really. Now that you called me and I have to get up at 6, why am I doing this? And we just used to laugh. It was fun. So MJ Magazine, issue 4 is coming out in 2 weeks. And it's got some really interesting issues. My nephew, who's 14, Jake, wrote an article on gun control for the What Is My Opinion section, and it's really, really, really good. And we've got a whole section on learning disabilities, and we have book reviews and a lot more, and I'm not going to tell you more because you have to read it. And I would like to welcome John Fishwick. How are you?
And welcome. I'm just fine, thank you, Fran.
And I'm going to open up the chat room.
Okay.
Because I know sometimes we actually get people that listen, and sometimes PJ listens also.
Okay, good.
Yeah, okay, good. That's just great. They're logging in. Great. Okay, that's good. Now that's
done. Okay, so you're opening up the chat room right now, are you, Fran?
I just did. That took a half a second. I'm very impressed with myself, only because I used to have an assistant, and I never did the phones by myself too. And then I realized when you do things yourself, they get done the right way.
Yes, absolutely.
My mom always said, if you want to get it done the right way, don't depend on anybody else. Depend on you. So
yeah,
what made you decide to write this book? And you
well,
said you wrote
good
it,
question.
Yeah.
Let me give you, if I have time, Fran, a little bit of background information,
okay,
and then I'll answer your question.
Sure.
About 10 years ago, and the book, incidentally, is semi-autobiographical, and you'll see why in a couple of minutes.
I knew that.
About 10 years ago, I decided to write a technical book based essentially on astronomy, geology, and evolution theory.
Okay.
Which, incidentally, the first letters of each spell age. I'm not quite sure what the hell has to do with it, but they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I traveled to England, and I went round all the various sites, the astronomy sites. After all, this is the universe in which we live. The geological sites and the evolution sites, which is essentially Darwin's home in Kent. And one of the reasons I was going there was to kind of get partway to answer the question, and it's an age-old question, and I would guess, Fran, that most of your listeners have at some point in their lives asked this question. Who are we? Why are we here? What's the purpose of it all? And I thought the three subjects that you should have a little bit of knowledge about that will help you on your way to answering that question are astronomy, our own universe, geology, the planet on which we live, and evolution, where we came from.
Mm-hmm.
So I started the book, and I was about halfway through when my first wife died of pancreatic cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked after her for the last year, and I kind of lost interest in writing the book. My heart kind of went out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met a wonderful lady about a year later from Chicago, who
nice.
Had lost her husband. And we got together, and we married, and it's been a wonderful experience for both of us. And she said, why don't you pick up the book where you left off? So I said, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Instead of writing a technical book, I'm going to keep the basis of the book the same, but write a novel. And so I had my male protagonist, Jeremy Rowlands, a professor of astronomy at University of Florida, he decides after his wife dies in a car accident on I-75 in a dense fog, he decides to go to Britain to answer the question, or to get partway to answering the question I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Who are we? Why are we here? What's the purpose of it all? Mm-hmm. So he plans a trip, 3 weeks in Britain. And it, quite independently of this, the lady protagonist, Stephanie Marks, is a retired teacher of English and art. And she lost her husband to cancer about 2 years ago. She wants to go to Britain to look, search out the homes and birthplaces of the famous authors and artists she taught her high school kids. Quite by chance, quite by coincidence, they find themselves sitting next to each other on a flight out of Newark to Heathrow. And during the long night, the several hours flight over the Atlantic, they gradually, at first the conversation is perfunctory, just mm-hmm. passing the time of day. Then they get to know why each other is going to Britain. And Stephanie, the lady protagonist, says, well, Jeremy, where's the first place you're going to visit?
Mm.
And Jeremy says, well, I'm going to go to the Geological Museum in London to look at the world's first geological map. He said, you know, Stephanie, it's also a piece of informational art. And I don't know whether you or any of your listeners have seen a geological map, but it's full of colors. One color for limestone, another for granite, a color for the chalk in Britain, and so on. So Stephanie thinks about it. She says, you know, I'd like to see that. That sounds interesting to me. So they agree that on the first visit, they would have a joint visit. And they do. And then Stephanie says, you know, you've taken me, Jeremy, to one of your sites. Let me take you to the National Gallery in London and show you some of the paintings that I love. Now, both of them, and I'm kind of talking directly to your listeners here, Fran, because many of them have either been divorced or they've had a death in the family, one of the spouses has died, and they're asked themselves, do I have a second chance?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking to them directly from my experience, you do. And if I had to say anything, I'd say, go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've had a lot of experience now before you either separated or you lost a spouse. You know what to look for the second time round. So anyway, that's how it got started. And if you'd like me to mention some of the sites we went to and the protagonists went to and what they discussed, I'll be happy to. But you tell me.
Well, I was going to ask that question. It's funny because in high school I had a choice of sciences, and I really hated biology because the professor was really not that versed in the subject. He was more versed instead reading the book. So the earth science and geology teacher was more hands-on. And we got to go to Wave Hill and a whole bunch of different places. So when it comes to rock formations in geology, you see, I would love to see that map. that
fabulous.
Would be my kind of thing. So that part of the book I couldn't put down, and I'm saying, okay, let me read this over. Let me see it. Let me see if I could visualize the colors of the limestone, the shale, and the granite in my head. So that was interesting.
Yes.
So,
well, of course, the limestone, it's called oolitic limestone, and this is mined to make the cottages in the Cotswolds. Mm. And I would guess that a lot of your readers have been to the Cotswolds, Burford and all those places, and they've seen the honey-colored cottages there, which are quite beautiful. And that's the limestone they've mined. And you can see it on the map. But anyway, one of the next sites, and one that intrigued me, I went to Cambridge University and saw the telescopes, the radio telescopes. Just for your listeners' benefit, you can't see anything optically through a radio telescope. It isn't like a normal one. You either send radio signals out into the galaxy, or you listen for radio signals. And the conversation at this point between Jeremy and Stephanie is essentially, what do we do if we actually get a signal that's not noise? We recognize it as a real signal, probably for some kind of extraterrestrial or alien. Because these people, when they send a signal, they maybe have a civilization a million years older than ours. And I'm going to pose to your listeners, what's the name of the paper in your hometown that people get in the morning?
Over here? They get the Journal News, or they get the Wall Street Journal, a lot of them, because I see them outside, and some of them get the Times. They don't have a daily news up here.
Okay. Now, supposing I'm asking your listeners, what could be the most startling headline that you could see in tomorrow morning's paper when you pick it up from the front path? And I would argue, Fran, the most startling headline is, "We have made contact," which means we've heard from somebody, it's not noise, and we can learn from them. And the question is, what would we ask them? And the logical question, I see it, would be, how do you arrange for world peace? How do you arrange society and politics to provide world peace? The other one is, and this applies to your mother, how do we solve Alzheimer's? Do you have a solution for that? How do you cure cancer? Because if they've been able to send a signal, they must be an advanced civilization that probably have answers to these questions. So I have my protagonists talk about that, and it's a subject that fascinates me.
Alzheimer's fascinates me too. I know. I watched my mother decline, and I watched her from 2002 when she was diagnosed. Oh, and she knew it. She told me that there was something wrong with her. She knew all the way to 2011, and I watched her decline slowly. And it was the funny part about it is that she actually knew who she was all the time. And she was kind of hilarious at times, too, because you never know their behavior. I know once in a while I would walk in and she would criticize the way I was dressed. And my sister, when she was alive, would say, "You see, I told you I was better. You know, I'm more proper than she is." And we just laughed. Or she would say, "Oh, you're here. Now you could leave because the good one just arrived." If anybody could figure out the cause, the real cause of Alzheimer's and how to stop it, that would be a miracle. If the spouses of each one of these people, of Stephanie's husband, David, or Jeremy's wife, would they have gone along on a trip like that?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, they would. And I'm interested, if any of your readers call in and maybe have read the book, I tried very hard to not make Stephanie what we call a deuteragonist. In other words, a foil for Jeremy, somebody like Ed McMahon was to Johnny Carson.
Gotcha.
I tried very hard to make them have equal footing. And some of my friends who read the book said, I think you succeeded. But anyway, what happened is when they went to England, both of them, both of the protagonists, Jeremy and Stephanie, have had the loves of their lives, and they're quite resigned to living the rest of their lives single, alone. And you'll see what happens is, as they gradually move through the various sites in Britain and talk about the things they're seeing, a very strong emotional bond forms between them. And they abandon their original thoughts of staying alone. They have a second chance. They took it. But one of the interesting sites that is in the book, they went to a little village up in Cheshire. Cheshire is one of the counties in Britain, northwest. and in a little village called Daresbury. And I would guess that most of your listeners who've been to England have never even heard of Daresbury. So I go to Daresbury, I park the car, and I walk over to the church. And as I am entering the church, the vicar from the local manse, the local his local house, walks over and gives me a tour of the church.
Nice.
And your listeners are probably saying, well, why is he telling me about a little village I've never heard of? And I'm telling you because in 1836, the vicar of that church was Charles Ludwig Dodson, otherwise known as Lewis Carroll.
Oh, wow.
Who was a great scientist on his own, a wonderful mathematician. And when you stand in the church and look at the big stained glass windows, they're all the characters of Alice Through the Looking Glass. They're all the March Hare, the Cheshire Cat, the Mad Hatter. And it's a kind of a fabulous little trip to see that and to look at the works of Lewis Carroll. And that was one of the chapters that I enjoyed writing.
Well, the chapter that I liked was the one about Shakespeare.
Yes.
And the Globe Theater. And I never realized that Shakespeare actually acted in his own plays and that the actors didn't really know. They did 11 plays. See, I did read this. And I didn't realize that they actually acted in their own play, but they didn't know the script until right before they were going to act it, and then somebody had to tell them. That was interesting to learn about the Globe Theater. The only thing that was missing, because the book was really good, was I was waiting for pictures. I was waiting for the pictures of the different places because the way you described them, I felt like I was there. And
well,
the fact
it's interesting you should say that because at some time in the future, we're going to have novels in which you embed little videos.
That'd be cool.
So when you're reading the novel, and let's say you are in the Globe Theater, it'll show a little picture, a little live 30-second picture of what the Globe Theater is like. But you know, it was interesting, Fran. In those days, actors were considered somewhat of a low life. They weren't regarded in England as good people to have at living next door. So they were forbidden to build a theatre in the city of London. And this is why the theatres were built outside the city, and that's where the Globe Theatre is, outside the city of London, which is kind of interesting. But now you've brought Shakespeare up.
I love Shakespeare.
It intrigues me because in a lot of Shakespeare's plays, they're either romance, history, or a tragedy. And if they've resolved the problem, it's resolved in Act 3. And in Act 3, if they've resolved the problem, it becomes a romance. If they haven't resolved the problem, like the fight between the Montagues and the Capulets in Romeo and Juliet, it becomes a tragedy. So we've got Stephanie now and Jeremy. They're falling for each other. They're up in the Lake District of northwest England. And the chapter Lady of the Lake is when Stephanie wakes up in the morning, overlooking one of the lakes in the Lake District, a beautiful day. She sees herself in the mirror, and she realizes she's not that bad after all. And she says to herself, okay, Stephanie, Act 3 is about to begin. And it does.
Well, she was getting a little flack from her daughter for a while, too, from Andrea, the skeptic.
Yes.
Yeah, well, you can't blame her.
No. In fact, this is what typically happens when husbands seek another wife after the first wife has died, or vice versa. The children are always saying, I wonder whether mom or dad really know what they're doing. Are they going into this with their eyes open? And there's always some concern, and they want to know more about who the other person is. and what their thoughts are. And I want to meet them before you marry Syndrome. But I thought of actually developing that idea, but although if I had have done, then the novel would have been far too long, and I had a choice between developing more of the sons and daughters, of the children, or bringing in science and art, and I chose the latter.
Well, it's a unique book because it's more like a friendship that develops through educational and intellectual ideas and learning than it is a pure romance. That's what really surprised me while I was reading it. Here I was expecting something else, and I'm saying, no, I'm not going to get that. So how did you decide on the different chapter headings? Because they're all kind of unique, and of course my other favorite one was Darwin and Evolution.
Yes.
I learned a lot.
Darwin, of course, is a controversial subject, and apparently as much as 40 or 45% of we Americans do not believe in evolution. And so when they read my comments on evolution theory and the reasons for it and the voluminous data supporting it, they may not be too happy, but I just simply ask them to read it, think it out for themselves, ask yourself the old question, is it plausible and where's the evidence? And I'm not trying to tell the reader what to believe. I'm leaving it up to his or her own judgment. But I find evolution theory absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I did also. Learning about Erasmus and all of it was really very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And the other thing, of course, I love art. So when you mentioned Van Gogh, Monet, and Gauguin, that was the other part. So how did you connect all of them, science, literature, and art, and encompass them all together?
Well, one of the things I do, I lecture at colleges, universities, country clubs, various other society meetings, and we go around the world on cruise ships, and I lecture on cruise ships. But one of my favorite lectures is on the relation of science and art, because if you go way back, you learn that the first thing they realized was perspective, and perspective is a kind of a science-based theory. And you go back to work by Giotto. And then you get into the beautiful Duomo in Florence and the architecture there and the relation between science and art. And then I'm particularly fascinated by Picasso's work. And when you look at some of Picasso's objects, you see them from more than one side. And this is what you would see if you were traveling at close to the speed of light. Now, I know that's a bit of a jump for most people, but the interesting point is Einstein's major work was on relativity was published round about the time that Picasso was doing his paintings. And the question is, did Picasso, in fact, know about the relationship of science when he painted some of his masterpieces? And the same thing applies to a lot of other people. I'm particularly interested in the painting The Scream. I don't know whether you're familiar with The Scream. It was actually, there were several versions of it, and it was stolen and then returned a few years ago. But a lot of people thought the reason for the bright red sunsets was Edvard Munch was psychotic. A more recent theory was just before, a year or two before he painted The Scream, there was a huge volcanic explosion in the Philippines at Tambora. And it threw dust up into the atmosphere, and the dust circled the atmosphere of Earth, and it produced bright red sunsets for two or three years. So it's interesting to speculate whether he was showing what science had produced.
I had the picture of it right in front of me. I just booted it up.
Did you? Yes.
Yes.
So it's interesting.
That's what
and
I did, because I like to see what, you know, it almost looks like a road. This, as a matter of fact, at the end of the painting, there's like two men, one bent over, one standing straight, and then this very odd figure in the front that's screaming, obviously, and the sky looks like it's in flames in one picture, and the other, it's sort of multicolored, and then there are two people hanging it on a wall.
Yes. Now, let me, while we're on the subject of art and science, I was on one of my lecture cruises this spring down in Mexico, down in the Yucatan, and there was a lecturer on board, and he was talking about Vermeer. So I thought, well, let me go along and hear what he has to say.
Mm-hmm.
And at question time, he asked for questions, and I said, do you think Vermeer used an optical aid to project the image onto a screen so he could make his paintings, something like a camera lucida? And the lecturer actually got quite excited. He said, nobody's ever asked me that. And he talked about it for some time. And then later in the cruise, we met a couple who we asked to join us for dinner. And she had written a book, and I bought hers, and she bought mine. And then she said, I've got a movie recommendation for you. It's called Tim's Vermeer. And it's quite fascinating. It's about a man who is not an artist himself, but he wanted to project an image of what he was trying to paint, and he was trying to copy a Vermeer. And it took him 5 years, but it's a kind of a fascinating movie, at least I found it so. And this kind of ties in, I realize I'm digressing here a little bit, but these
That's
are
okay.
some of the things that fascinate me. About 2 years ago, we were downtown Naples, Florida, for an art show on Fifth Avenue. They close the street and they bring the painters in and the exhibits. And there was a painting that a man had copied. He was a German. He'd copied the girl with the pearl earring. And we came home, and my wife said, I've got to have that. And she went back downtown, and she bought it. It wasn't that expensive, like $600, $800, something like that.
Not too bad, yeah.
But it's a beautiful painting, and it's hanging in the bedroom, the girl with the pearl earring, and I can't obviously compare it side by side with the original, but it's very good indeed. And so this is another example where science, in the idea of projecting an image, marries art. And there's a lot of other examples like that, like the Salvador Dali, the persistence of time, in which you have melting clocks. But anyway, I find a lot of these things, Fran, fascinating. And my publisher asked me, what stimulated you to write the novel?
Yeah.
And I started off by saying, I'm fascinated by everything except fashion and basketball.
Oh, I love fashion. Sorry. And my nephew is 14, and I saw them 2 weeks ago, and he got me to play basketball. I used to be really good at it. I was really very, very good at it when I was younger. And
well, you must be tall. How tall are you, Fran?
I'm not. I'm 5 feet tall, and I'm 109 pounds. And
oh,
I used to be able to. I was able to jump higher. And I said to him, Jake, if you want your aunt to shoot baskets, you're going to have to lower the thing because it's 10 feet. So he did. He lowered it to 8 feet, and I was pretty good. I was able to do it. But I want to strengthen my arms again, so I have to get a better pair of sneakers. So I said, will you settle for 18 holes of golf? So we played golf afterwards.
Oh, good.
Points. I creamed them, but I felt much better. But he said to me, you know, I can't believe that you could do this. I said, don't even go there. I said, I am, you know, pretty good shape for a young in-between person. And what they cracked up was that I'm blonde, and I have spiky blonde hair. And my sister loved blue, and my mother loved blue, so I put two blue extensions on the right side of my hair. It looks cute. They're the only ones that hated it. But then that's me. I'm just really different, but I love fashion. My mom made me fashion conscious, and if I didn't look prompt, if I didn't look the right way, or respectful or professional, she would actually seriously send me upstairs to change. She called my principal one day and told her that I wasn't going to be on time for my reading group, and I was the assistant to the assistant principal and the dean, and she would say, she's not dressed properly, she's going to be late. And I said, you didn't actually call my principal. Yes, she did. She did. She actually called one day and said, it's snowing outside and my daughter's not coming. I walked to work. I'm like, yeah, okay. She would do stuff like that. She was a perfectionist, and if it wasn't exactly right, if there was a spot on a shoe, she would make me go upstairs and change it because I wasn't going to go to work not looking right. And my principal said, well, if your mother didn't like it, I wasn't going to like it either.
Yeah, well, this is good. In fact, my wife is the one, when I lecture on cruise ships, she's the one who inspects me very carefully to make sure I haven't got toothpaste on my mouth or stains on my shirt when I'm lecturing.
She's my kind of person, without a doubt.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, let me just—I'm not sure how long you want me to talk, but
we have about another 28 minutes, which is pretty good.
Oh, we do. Okay.
Yes, I was hoping you would describe the other place I really was fascinated. See, I love astronomy too. That was the other subject that I loved teaching in school. It's funny because when I took science in the elementary school and college, I had such bad teachers in high school that all of us sat there and said, well, now that we're learning to be educators, would you teach us the subject? So the professor had to actually teach us the subject because it was so poorly taught in high school and in junior high that we didn't know enough about biology or anything, even though we did, and could pick it up from the book that we made them teach to us. The other favorite place was the Herschel Museum. That was interesting.
Oh, yes. Well, Herschel was an interesting guy. He was a musician in Germany before he came over, and he and his sister lived in Bath. I don't know whether you've ever been to Bath, the site of the old Roman baths. And I went there, and it's kind of hard to find the Herschel home, but it's fascinating when you get there. But, you know, astronomy, let me back off a little bit here. You were talking about education.
Mm-hmm.
One of the subjects that interests me, and I'm not really an educator like a lot of people who've taught high school for 30 years. I certainly can't compete with them. But I do teach, and I do teach on cruise ships, so I am kind of a partial educator.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of appalled when we read the reports on where we as a country stand when compared to other first world countries in terms of math and verbal English and so on. We end up almost at the bottom. We're beaten by companies like Finland and Lithuania and, of course, China and Korea and Israel and Canada. And we end up always on these surveys at the very end. And this subject comes up a lot at when we have dinner with friends.
Mm-hmm.
I go out to dinner, incidentally, not particularly for the food, but for the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often it turns to education. And have you any thoughts, Fran, because I'm sure you've been through this. Let me make you temporarily the director of education in the United States. What would you do to improve the level of education in our country?
You know, it's funny that you should ask that because many of us have discussed it. And to be very honest, a lot of it is that they're teaching to tests. Teachers, from what I get from my friends that are still in teaching, and I do work with my nephews because they're in high school and I help them a lot with their projects, a lot of times they're teaching, they're not teaching the subject. The kids are more concerned about passing the ELA, which is the English Language Arts Assessment Test, given in the fourth grade and eighth grade. From when I graded that test and I work with the teachers and train them to pass the test, they don't deal with grammar. A lot of times you can get a high score on a test even if you have one grammar errors. In other words, a perfect score might be 4, but a 2 is passing. They've lowered the standards. Also, from what I gathered from my friends, they don't do spelling, which is bad. They don't do punctuation. The teachers are given a canned thing. This core curriculum is a disaster, absolutely disastrous.
Yep.
And I've looked it up. I mean, my friends ask me for help. I'll help write lesson plans for them, even though I'm not there. And they're not given, the teachers aren't given the creativity that I had when I was working. And the last year that I taught, I felt it. I was the dean, and then I decided I love teaching reading because that's my thing. I can teach you all how to read. And I would work with the kid with difficult fifth graders and fourth graders and third graders. And the fifth graders would say, you know, I would say to them, you know what, I come 4 times a week, and basically I was only supposed to come 3, but whatever. I said, I'm going to give you one day where we can read whatever you want because I'm going to use my creative juices. My principal was like, "You can't." I said, "I can do whatever I want. I'm here 30-something million years." I said, and at this point in my life, since I'm retiring, I'm going to do it my way. I've always done it my way. She was the only principal that did not have a high regard for any program other than, can you cover the class because the teacher's absent?
Yes.
And it's fair. I think supervisors need to remember that they're educators. I think they need to get back into the classroom. I think they need to be able to model a lesson. I think that she doesn't know how to. A lot of them don't know how to. They're just, you know, oh, you can't handle the class, blah, blah, blah. I never had trouble with discipline. I'm good. I'm little, I'm tough, but I'm fair.
What I hear you saying, I think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, I hear you saying that we're teaching our kids what to think, not how to think.
Exactly. We're teaching them this is how you have to do it, and if you do it this way, you're going to pass the test. There are even canned responses to do it. On the ELA, if you do the short answer things, we would teach them to say, in the story it said, or take the words in the question. If the question was, how did the character change, you would say, the character changed by. Now, when I graded a specific school, because you didn't grade your own, I found that every child had the same answers to certain questions. And I went up to the test coordinator for the district, and I'm saying, this is kind of strange that every student has the same canned response and that all of their responses are the same. How can you pass? How can you not think that they didn't, that there's something strange with their scores?
Yes.
And she said, well, you know, they can do it. I said, you know what? We taught them to, it's called echo response, but all of our responses in my school are different. And they were giving them ones and twos. I said, good. Now that you keep telling me to give them threes and fours, which I didn't, I said, you're going to go back over my school because my kids actually passed, you know, read the stuff and did it and gave you answers that made sense. But you could have the compositions were how did you spend the day with your friend? And it was graded on content, but basically there was no grammar. Grammar is not taught.
No. Actually, you know, let me tell you a little true story, and I'm going to take you back many, many years. I'd only been in the States, obviously from England. I'd only been in the States a couple of years when I was invited to a parent-teachers meeting at the local school where my son was, I don't know how old he was, 6 or 7 or whatever. And when it came question time, I asked them, I said, now, I'm assuming at the end of the year we'll get a report telling us where my son stands in class, whether he was first or 15th or 28th. Or whatever. And there was complete silence in the room. And I thought, what did I say wrong? And the answer was, no, I'm sorry, we don't do that here. We can't
do
that.
They don't rank. They don't rank. But they rank on the test.
And I guess the reason is they don't want some kids at the bottom of the class to feel slighted in some way that they were 28. And so that was my first feeling of what we were up against. And then I'm going to jump a little bit here. In the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson wrote something like, all men are created equal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't want to upset your listeners, but nothing could be further from the truth. You simply have to look at the difference in heights, the difference in weight, the difference in body color, the difference in hair color, eye color, and you can see that there's a whole variety of people. And the same thing applies to IQ. There are some very bright and some not so bright.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know when you taught, Fran, mm-hmm. whether you had streaming, whether you tended to put the top IQ people in the same class and the second group of IQ people and so on. I think you call it streaming.
Is this popular
in the United States now or not?
It depends on the school. It depends on the principal. When I first started, they did. They had the top classes had the music class had all the bright children that had, you know, music in sixth grade because I was on sixth grade. Then there was a class that was equally as bright in sixth grade, and they grouped them according to reading levels from the year before. Eventually, what happened was they decided that that was too stigmatized for the, you know, for the children that were low, so they decided to do it differently. They had top, middle, and bottom. So when that teacher couldn't answer you, do they grade them or do they rank them? Yeah, they do. Because when you did the class ranking at the end of the year, you actually did rank the students, the boys on one side and the girls on the other, boy one, boy two, boy three, boy four. And then when you went to make index cards and you mixed them up, so if you were putting, if there were five classes, you would take each of the five boys and put them across, one, two, three, four, five. Then you would take the girls, not in the same class, one, two, three, four, five, and then you did the same with the girls. And then you would have to take out your discipline problems. So if a student you rated in discipline or a fair rating, you took out the discipline problems first, even though they might have been ranked number one or two. So, yeah, they did a lot of that. They did a lot of that. They regrouped in that particular case. But there was always, for some reason, one particular teacher that would get if the principal really didn't like them, seriously, 12 U's, 12 unsatisfactories. They didn't do it equitably. They really didn't.
No.
And when Thomas Jefferson said created equally, he should have meant treated equally.
Because that
is the problem with this world. People are not treated equally. Color, race, whatever. And I look at people as however they are. I don't look at the person by where they come from. I think the most telling example is after 9/11, there was a student in my school that was from Pakistan. And he came over to me because I was the dean, and he said, you know, Mrs. Lewis, I'm afraid I'm going to get beaten up when I got out of school. I said, not on my watch or not, because he was threatening. And I walked outside. I said, I dare anybody to do anything. And I said, I dare you to do anything. They didn't. They just like, she's going to do something, whatever. And I protected him because he was, it's a lot. I know he came from over there, and it wasn't his fault that what happened. And the kids were, you know, learned to make some friends. He also didn't speak English, too. And we also had to teach him, and he learned all the good words, too, by the way. They always learn the good words. But he, at the end of the year, he thanked me. He said, you protected me. I said, that's my job. I said, my job is to make sure that no one gets hurt. My job, little me, I mean, I broke up fights because I was told as a dean I had to. Did any child try to hurt me? Never. Not in all the years I was there. Did I get hurt? Yeah, because sometimes, you know, you don't know your own strength. I think the worst thing that ever happened.
On hearing you talk, Fran, you left teaching too soon.
I left when my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And I did not.
Yeah.
He's still there, unfortunately. If the principal that was there before that was still there, she would never have let me retire. This person said to me, you are tough. The kids respect you. Don't you think you should back off and let the teachers fail? I said, no one fails in my watch, not the children, not the teachers, but you do at this point.
Yes.
And she didn't like me. She just said, I can't, you know, you're confrontational. I said, no. I said, that's because one of us cares, and I don't think it's the one sitting in your chair. So when I retired, she said, did you find this hard? I said, if you would retire, I wouldn't. I said, it's the easiest decision I've ever made because you just don't care about my beautiful, precious children. I taught in a tough school in the Bronx, and I loved every minute of it. And you know what was really funny is that we taught the classics. I taught Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Ah, yes, wonderful.
The Count of Monte Cristo, Phantom of the
yes.
Opera. My favorite book in the whole universe is The Invisible Man. And I love Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I love Sherlock Holmes mysteries. And the
fabulous.
Kids love them. So I would literally go out and buy 30 copies of each book.
Yeah, would you?
And,
yes.
And bring them to class. We would talk about it in different ways. I would actually, acted out Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and got some cranberry juice and pretended it was the potion or whatever. And acted,
I
went a whack.
Yeah. You mentioned Sherlock Holmes.
I love
and
Sherlock Holmes.
I often use one of his quotes when we're talking about, things like climate change, which is always a popular subject.
Yeah.
When you're trying to analyze the difference between renewable and non-renewable energy and so on. And I believe it was in The Sign of the Four when Holmes says to Watson, when you eliminate the impossible, whatever you have left, however improbable, is the truth. And you can apply that statement to a lot of modern-day subjects. For instance, in energy, when you eliminate those things that are simply not going to be a source of our long-term energy future, you see what you've got left. And even though your listeners may not like this, the logical thing you've got left is nuclear. And a lot of people get scared because they hear the word radiation and they immediately, the backs go up. But light is radiation. Radio waves are radiation. And the question is, we've used nuclear reactors in aircraft carriers and ships in the United States with no accidents for the last 30 years. In fact, I think I'm correct in saying that there has not been one death from nuclear reactors, nuclear radiation in the United States ever, even in Three Mile Island. But then you look at coal, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people have died from black lung disease.
That's true.
So it's interesting. Let me mention one more thing about education, because it fascinates me. I often am asked in lectures, somebody says, my son is 18 and he's going to college. What advice would you have for him? And I say, well, I want you to fast forward 4 years. It's now 4 years from now. He's graduated, or she has graduated, and she or he is sitting behind a desk being interviewed by somebody for a job. And the interviewer says, now, what have you got? What knowledge do you have that I'm willing to purchase? And you say, well, I had a very big course in basket weaving. Or I studied whale watching off the Baja coast in California. Now, those people are going to go home. They're going to wait for the phone call to their house, offering them a job at $60,000 a year. And it's never going to come. Because if you don't study something that's marketable, that's saleable, I mean, you have to like what you're going to do, of course. But if, and I'm on a touchy subject with you, Frank, because you're an English teacher, but if you say, I've studied all of the novels of Jane Austen, now, that's great. In fact, it's excellent if you're going to be a teacher. But if you don't want to teach, you're not going to get too far with that knowledge. So it's somehow what they choose to major in that's of great importance. And
that is so true. That is so true, because when I went to college, I went to Hunter College. And
yes. Oh,
I heard of Hunter,
yes.
Yes, I went to Hunter College, and I went in and I really wanted, this is really amazing, to major in language, because I
yes.
loved French and Hebrew and Spanish and whatever. I love language or English. And the dean called me in and he said, you can't major in language. I go, I thought I was a free country and I could major whatever I want.
Right.
And he read on my sixth grade teacher, this was hilarious, I never knew it was there, that I was very shy. I said, that may have been when I was 10, that's not now, sorry. And
yeah.
That's not now. I said, I said to him, why would I want to major in anything other than what I want to major in? I wound up majoring in music because I play the piano and the violin. And he said,
wonderful.
You would be perfect to major in music. Well, for those people out there that have never majored in anything, and music is the hardest thing in the world. I have to tell
yep.
you. It is probably, it's more difficult than any other subject because you can't remember, you have to know it. And it has to be in you. You have to be able to transpose, write a sonata, write a symphony, be able to identify every aria and every opera by when the
yes.
producer just drops the needle. And I knew Wagner cold, and it was hard. And
wonderful.
The only other thing I couldn't do, I can't sing. So I had to take voice. And
yep.
true story, I had to pass voice very hard.
Yep.
And you had
yes.
to sing Don Giovanni. I had to sing the other operas. And I said to the professor, I have perfect pitch in my head. Can I sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star? I mean, it was for real. It was kind of funny.
Yeah.
And one of the professors that taught voice said, you're absolutely adorable. I really think you're cute. I'm going to give you a B just to keep your mouth shut. I said, I'll take the B just to keep my mouth shut.
Yeah.
I couldn't sing, and I knew that I could hear the notes, and I could write it out, and I could transpose in my head, and I was able to do everything. I couldn't sing, so when everybody got up on stage and had to sing an aria, I got up and sing, and they play the accompaniment. I said, could you please play Twinkle, Twinkle,
yeah.
Little Star, and play the right notes? And
yes.
they did. I just laughed it off, and I was a big one. I graduated college. I was
yeah.
18. It's like,
wow.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty smart. What could I say? But I started teaching when I was 19, and that was scary enough, too.
Super. Yeah. Well, it's
yeah.
interesting talking about music. And I don't want to fall into lecture mode here, but I would guess there's many of your listeners who
mm-hmm.
will live their lives and die never having heard a Beethoven piano concerto,
oh, God,
a Mozart
so
symphony,
much.
Or Barber's Adagio for strings.
Mm.
And if only they would try listening to these things, because Barber's Adagio for strings is quite sublime. And it's a wonderful experience for relaxation and, if you like, meditation. But so I think, even though I'm a scientist, music has played a great role in my life. But
I love music, and even when I was teaching, I would bring in the classical music and have the kid just listen, but then I would have them illustrate, draw to the music, draw something.
Yes.
Just take a pen, take a crayon, and whatever comes, whether it's a design or a picture or whatever, just draw to, let the pencil and the crayons flow to the music. Oh, they loved it.
Yes, yeah.
Absolutely.
But, you know, staying on education for a minute, because... And I'm more than a little biased being a scientist, but to a very large extent, what made this country in which we live great? It was made essentially through science and technology. And this is the future. What's going to happen in the future is when we solve Alzheimer's through biological research, when we improve the knowledge of computers, manufacturing, technology, and yet when kids go to school, very few of them end up studying science or technology.
It's not taught the right way. Seriously not
yes.
taught the right way. And I know it from my nephews because even language and literature is not taught the same right way. I mean, my nephew had to read The Scarlet Letter.
Yes.
One of them had to read the Boy in the Striped Pajamas, and
yes.
they called me. I read all of them, and I didn't do the homework for them, but we talked about it and discussed it because they said that the teacher just gave them this packet of questions, and graphic organizers and stuff. And I said, that's not the way you teach literature. You get up there and you talk about it and you discuss, you know, the characters and you talk about the message that the author was trying to say. He had to write a book review on The Boy with the Striped Pajamas, and he says, well, that's what you do. I said, we're going to talk about the book. I'm going to explain how you do it, and then you're going to do it. He did a great job. It was fantastic.
Yes, fabulous.
But you know what? Kids are not taught. They're not taught to love science like you love science. So if you got up in a high school class, you know the subject, you love the subject, you don't need a textbook to teach it.
Yes. Well, you know, you've kind of triggered something else here in my mind. I teach fifth graders from time to time. I'm not, as I said, a regular teacher, but I do it for fun. And the interesting thing is, when I teach the fifth graders astronomy, and I ask them, who wants to come up on the board and draw something about the planets? Almost every hand in the audience goes up. The kids want to come up, and they want to draw Saturn's rings and Jupiter's moons and the sun shining. They often have it all wrong, but that's okay. They want to learn, and it's fun teaching them. Then I go to 10th grade. The curiosity is gone.
That's right.
Very few want to come up. Very few don't feel comfortable speaking in front of their peers about anything. Now,
that's
the
right.
Question is, why, you're a teacher, why is it that in many cases the curiosity goes when you go from fifth grade to 10th grade?
Because the teachers in the lower grades, well, at least when I was teaching, when you're teaching science or you're teaching a subject in elementary school, the kids' minds are open and they want it. They love raising their hands. I mean, I would have them write a story or something. They would come up and we would play, can you rate this story, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or everybody has to give it a ranking, but nobody could give it less than 3. And they would share. They would love to. In high school,
yes.
It depends on who's standing in front of you. And a lot of times with science, there's a textbook in front of you. And in my case, when I was being taught biology, the professor wrote the book. And he just said, okay, put the slides on. And there's a lack of interest in the person that's teaching it. And a lot of times high school kids don't realize it's okay to be smart. And it's not cool to get up there in front of a group of kids. They have to be made to feel, you know, it doesn't matter whether your friends think it's okay. You have to do it because you think it's okay. A lot of them just feel it's not cool to be smart. It's cooler to act ridiculous, or it's cooler to just sit there and not say. And, you know, if you're going to teach science through a textbook, that textbook is old. That textbook is old the minute you take it out. But if I taught reading and I taught to pick up stories on the internet. I mean, my fifth graders were tough. So they would say, can we read about Goldberg and the Hulk and and all the wrestlers? I mean, yes, you can. Oh, of course, sure you can. Because the stories on the internet about the wrestlers were more difficult than some of the things that they were expected to read in their class. And we would talk about their lives, the autobiographies. I got to know the people that they watched on television, and they got a better understanding of who they are.
Yeah.
Even the rap singers. But if I said to them, I want you to read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, well, my problem was that I would come into my room. I had to share a room with a whole bunch of people, which was ridiculous. And I would come back and I'd go like, there are 5 Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde's missing. They would come in and borrow them and forget to give them back. So by the end of the year, they would say, well, you're retiring anyway, so we're just going to all take a couple of these classics and reread them. I think that was probably the best compliment I could have ever gotten, is that, they want to read anything but, besides Beverly Cleary and Judy Blume, they wanted to read the classics and Sherlock Holmes they loved, especially the critical thinking that you had to go to figure out who did it. But anyway,
well, I kind of think that we fall short on metaphors when we teach. This is putting complex subjects in easy-to-understand forms. And let me give you a couple of examples, Fran. A friend of mine taught Hispanic kids here who English was not their first language, but they wanted to improve themselves. They were anywhere from the age of 8 to 13 or 14. And she was out of town for a couple of weeks doing some work down in Guatemala. And she said, John, would you teach my class for me a couple of times? So I did, and I taught them elementary math, addition, subtraction, division, you know, this kind of thing. But then I had about a quarter of an hour left over at the end, and I thought, I'm going to try something on these kids. I'm going to try teaching them something that nobody would ever even think of doing. I'm going to teach them relativity theory by Einstein. But I used metaphors, and it worked. And I was a little surprised, but they got the idea pretty quickly. And it's the same kind of thing, and I'm going to switch subjects a little bit here. Mm. How often do you watch the evening news and you're told by the news commentator that we owe $17 trillion, we're $17 trillion in debt? Mm-hmm. Now, it's useless telling people that. I haven't a clue what $17 trillion is, and I would bet that most of your listeners haven't either.
No, I don't think they would know either.
No, but I keep saying to myself, why don't they put it as a metaphor and say, all right, you've got a family of four, father, mother, and two kids. They live in a little house in the suburbs, and the family income is about $50,000 a year, give or take some. And they can relate to that. And then you say, now this family finds themselves in debt to the extent of $1.5 million. That they can understand.
Mm-hmm.
That they can follow, because that's their everyday life. And then when you've got that across, you say, and that's what it's like for us as a country to owe $17 trillion in debt.
Mm.
But there's always a metaphor to be used to explain things. And now, I'm going to change subject a little bit, Fran, because I'm interested in your opinion on this.
Okay.
There's a professor at Harvard who has something like 175,000 students in his class.
Whoa.
Because he teaches online.
Uh-huh.
He's a charismatic professor. He knows how to teach. And yet the kids, at one fraction of the cost of going to a brick-and-mortar building, can get an education from a guy who knows how to teach. Now, you as a teacher would probably say to me, yeah, I know what you're saying, John, but there's problems there. And there are. But a lot of science teachers in high school have a degree in history.
That's right.
And they're just told to teach science because we can't get any scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they don't know scientists, the kids are not going to learn science. Now, and I'm asking you this question, would it be better in that case to have a big TV screen, which they're used to looking at, and show a lecture by a charismatic professor who uses metaphors to teach, and then you have a teacher on hand to try and answer any questions? Would something like that work in today's high schools?
It probably would interest the kids a whole lot more. Because,
yes.
I mean, I get it from my nephews. Like I said, they're in high school, and one's in college going for law. And I saw the overload of work that he got this first year in college, because he would call me at 1 o'clock in the morning to explain something to him, and I'd go like, okay, I'm going to look up The Burden of History by whatever his name is. Okay, I'm going to read the book, read all 37
yes.
pages. I did. I read a whole bunch of books that he had to read, and we
yes.
talked about them at 2 o'clock in the morning. I think that if the professor had actually not said to them, read this, and talked about it and explained it. I even read the comments on a lot of the essays that all three of them wrote, and I could tell
yes.
that they were sort of canned comments. I think if you had a screen and they actually see the person and actually could see the experiment and understand it, and the professor explained it, and someone was there to answer their questions, I think that you wouldn't have all the boredom. And you wouldn't be sitting in a high school class with kids throwing paper airplanes.
Yes.
And staring out at the window. But we have about 2 more minutes left. So what are you writing next?
Well, my second book is about 80% complete.
Okay.
And a very quick synopsis, Fran.
Okay, good, because I
my protagonists, are now back in the States. They're married,
oh,
as you would
sequel.
Expect.
Oh, good. Oh, sequel.
Yeah, yeah, it's the same two protagonists.
Oh, I was wondering. Ah, cool.
Yeah. Now, they decide that in Gainesville, Florida, where Jeremy is still teaching astronomy, and they decide to celebrate their first wedding anniversary by going to a restaurant just out of town. It's a restaurant they've never been to before.
Oh, nice.
And they're sitting down having their meal, reminiscing about the trip to Britain and what they learned.
Mm-hmm.
And they notice at the far end of the restaurant, there's a couple of guys in suits talking animatedly over the contents of a briefcase.
Ah.
And the guys in the briefcase pay their bill and leave. And shortly after that, Jeremy and Stephanie pay their bill, and he pays cash, not with a credit card, and this will become obvious as you get through the book why he did that. They go out to the parking lot, and there on the side of the parking lot is the briefcase. Now, presumably what had happened is the guy was searching for his keys, put the briefcase on top of the car, and drove off. The briefcase falls off the car onto the side of the parking lot. So Jeremy says to Stephanie, well, let me open it up in case there's a business card in there. He opens it up, and there's one document in the briefcase. In big red letters, it says, confidential. Against his better judgment, Jeremy leaps through the document and says to Stephanie, let's get out of here fast. He puts the briefcase back where it was, gets in the car and drives off. He obviously knows something he's not supposed to know.
Mm.
So book one is a romance, book two is a thriller.
Oh, that's even better. You know why? Because a lot of the books I read are mystery thrillers. And what I do is, when this comes out, I do every couple of months, I do Mystery Thriller Thursday, and I invite like 4 or 5 authors to talk about their villains, their mysteries, how they created them, and we have like a round-robin discussion.
Right.
And it's a lot of fun. I did that last week with David Morrell. Dennis Parsons, Larry Thompson, Alan Topol, and Mark Rubenstein. I did one with them. It was really, and Roger Ellery from England. I love my Roger.
Oh,
Ellery.
Wonderful!
Yeah,
now, just before I leave, this has been a fascinating conversation for me.
Yes, it is interesting.
Just before I leave you, my website is John-Fishwick, that's JOHN-FISHWICK.com, John-Fishwick.com, and on the website it gives my background, my list of lectures, a synopsis of the book, where you can buy it. It's now available on Kindle, and if we've intrigued any of your listeners to have a read, great.
And I hope you're going to write an article for MJ Magazine. PJ has your email. I don't have it. But
yes, in fact, I'd be happy to. If you get my email from PJ, send me a list of the kind of format, the length that is suitable for your magazine, and I'd be happy to write something.
I'm going to send you, what I'll do is I'll send you a copy of MJ3. I'll email it to her. And she can email it to you so that you could see the type of articles. We write articles about current issues. I would love a science article.
Wonderful.
I would love something on science or astronomy or geology or anything that's going to create controversy.
Excellent.
That would be really great. So I will tell her.
Okay. Well, look, this has been a fascinating time with you. I wish you success with the MJ magazine.
Thank you.
And maybe when my second book is published, you'd be kind enough to have me on again.
Definitely, because I can't wait to read the second one. It's more up my speed. I love mystery thrillers. As a matter of fact, for those people that don't know, on July 11th, they're having the Fan Fest in Manhattan, and I was invited by one of the authors. So I'm going to be at the Mystery Thrillers, and I can't wait to meet Steve Berry and Linda Fairstein and all of them. It's the first time I've ever done anything like that. So, yes, you will definitely be invited back on, without a doubt.
Thank you, Fran. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sean. I appreciate it. And everybody,
bye-bye now.
I will be back in August. I'm taking the rest of the summer off. And have a nice night.
Good. Thank you, Fran.